Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to After Things, the podcast that comes after Weird Things, where we talk about being a creative, trying to work in this world. Joining us are, you know, my co-hosts, who've always been my co-hosts, Tom Merritt.
It's great to be here again, Andrew, as always.
Brian Brushwood.
Indeed it is. What do you think of the use of the word creative as a noun? Being a creative, I think it's been fairly recently that I've heard it used that way, but I like it. I'm okay with that.
Are you nouning an adjective when you do that?
I think I am. Yeah,
I think it fits because there are so many areas that overlap, and so you take Tom's a guy gets up every day, records multiple podcasts, and may not. And again, Tom's a writer too, whatever. But Tom's main thing is Tom is going to, you know, do these interviews, put together these shows and do that sort of thing and create this content that other than the day of doesn't know where it's going to come from, but then generates this massive content. You know, my day is, and I want to talk a little bit, like I sit down at a keyboard and I have an outline. I'm going to make this thing called a book. I'm going to make this sort of thing called book. And there is so much overlap between those kinds of worlds. And if you're an actor, you know, you're a creative and you say, okay, I'm going to go be part of a creative enterprise. I'm going to go do this. And there's going to be, you know, I think it's a helpful thing that sort of it explains the overlap.
So all three of us, I think, have had wildly diverse. We seem to dabble in a lot of different things. I would say Tom is the most specialized. No, because you are mainly forward facing as a news aggregator and presenter and not pundit. You give
analyst, pundit,
analyst,
whatever.
There you go. That's the word I'm looking for. But and yet you have this completely other artistic field where you write books and you know outside of that what other pies do you got your fingers in?
Well, can I throw in one too?
Yeah,
when he does FSL.
Yes. Oh, that's right. Yeah, you may not think of it this way, but you're a comedian.
The show.
Yeah, yeah, you're a comedian in that show, and I know that's a weird thing to be told, but yeah, it's
my paintings, you know, and
wait,
sketches. No, I'm just kidding.
I was about to say, do you have paintings?
My tattoos I designed.
No, there are definitely things that I do not consider myself any good at. Painting is one of them.
How important is it as a kickoff question? Do you guys think it is to have more than one domain that you're good at? And, you know, this is obviously not a new idea. We would watch Frank Sinatra sing, and then suddenly he's an actor. He's in movies and so on. And, you know, we see Mario Lopez is an actor, and now all of a sudden he's a news correspondent for Extra or whatever.
Important for what?
That's a good question. You know, to have a successful career as a creative, I guess.
Because I feel like it is important as a well-rounded human being to try to experience lots of different things, some of which you will become better at, some of which you won't. But there are certain things that you know you're a little bit better at and you can just devote more time. The more time you devote to anything, the better you'll get at it. And so I think it's important as a human being to try lots of different things and try to get better at the ones you like. For your career, that's a whole different question. Because there's an argument that if you do too many different things, you'll never build up momentum enough in one of them. But at the same time, if you're Frank Sinatra and you've built up this huge momentum in singing, then it might be just as important for you to diversify and say, hey, I can also be an actor in this and that, so that you're not putting all of your eggs in one basket if your voice blows out like it did on him in the late 40s.
Well, so Andrew, Tom is kind of gently dovetailing into something that I talked to him about. I sort of worked out one of the two presentations I gave out in Kuala Lumpur. One was this loose idea I had that there's sort of an endless cycle of I brought everything in my career back to street performing. When I started, I had neither a product nor a platform. And I had a loose idea for a product. I had a couple of routines I knew how to do. I had like 20 minutes of material, but I needed a platform. And, you know, since nobody was hiring me, I had no, you know, pre-internet stuff. I guess I could have tried to have done cable access, as many people did. But I knew that all of the great magicians that I respected had started off street performing. So I was like, well, you know, I'm going to go out on the street and perform. Ain't nobody can tell me no, except for the cops, who eventually did. And you know, if somebody likes it, they can throw me some money. And it was a great process during which I refined the product. And once I had product, I needed to find a bigger platform than the streets. And so, you know, I mailed postcards. I did direct response mailing. I did cold calling. I went to conferences. I showed up on doorsteps. And eventually, flash forward 4 years later, I had a success, you know, I was touring 150, 200 days out of the year. And at some point, that was the product. The product was the college stage show. But when I wanted to start something new, when I wrote the Skeptic Lecture, Scam, Sasquatch, and the Supernatural, what was the product was suddenly the platform. That was the way I could sell the new lecture, because everyone knew me as the guy who toured around those colleges. And then because I was that guy, I was able to get the word out and sell this lecture. And then from there, that product eventually became a platform from which I could pitch a TV project to Court TV that eventually fizzled, but gave rise to Scam School. And so again, the platform of being a college performer, which again, those were products, now they were platform, was what I used to encourage everyone to check out Scam School. Flash forward, you know, 4 or 5 more years, Scam School is now very popular, fairly popular. And it, what was the product, the thing I was trying to get people to try and experience, is now the platform that allows us to launch the Scam School book and eventually Scam Stuff. And rapidly, Scam Stuff is getting to the point where enough people are buying stuff and the email list is getting big enough that all of a sudden that product is going to become a platform for who knows what else next. So I guess that's what I mean as far as the benefit of having your finger in a bunch of different pies. And I agree, you shouldn't have 5 of them to start, but you should have one until you could get that product to the level of it being a platform that you could roll into something else.
Yeah, I'm a believer that, you know, I'm a guy that's always tried to do like a million things at once at my own detriment. And the things that I focused on the longest or the most intensely on were the ones that brought me the most success. Now, I spent, you know, a decade working on getting on TV and being able to sort of, you know, have the ability to sort of, you know, do that. And, you know, finally I got there and I didn't get the thing that I set out for, but then that opened up the door for a project I'll talk about at some other point, you know, for that. And that worked out great. It was exactly what I wanted and got to the position like, oh, great, the thing I wanted to do 10 years ago, which then 5 years ago didn't look like nobody could do it, now looks like it could happen. And I think that, you know, that was a thing for me, having every morning I woke up, I said, this is the one thing that I will work for. There will be other projects today. There will be other things I do. But today, every day, the primary project is this. When I got into writing, it was 4 years ago now, I realized that I got super intent into writing that first year when I said, man, there's this awesome outlet that doesn't have to rely on anybody else. I wrote 6 books my first year. I wrote 6 books that first year. And, one book, you know, been in continuous, you know, was in continuous development for film from everybody was involved in it, from the Transformer producers to Blumhouse, you know, who do Paranormal Activity. And now officially got announced Friday, the producers of Still Alice, the Julianne Moore film, his name is James Brown. He's a great producer, very, very sharp guy. He has optioned the rights for Public Enemy Zero to be made into a film.
Yeah.
Congratulations. So we'll see. That's awesome.
You know, I have
that's
super
an option, but still, it's good. Well, and that's the thing is again, I used to always worry about, you know, whenever there was some kind of deal, if you were allowed to talk about it, oftentimes I'd keep my mouth shut because I didn't want to jinx it or whatever. But then I realized more than often than not, these options, you know, just expire, and that's as far as they go. And so to me, it's like the joy of having gotten that far in the tournament is its own reward. And so I'll tell everyone about that stuff as soon as I'm able.
Yeah, you know, for this too, like, and part of what happens too is you keep going along with things, you get other people supportive. And so that deal happened because of Marcel Sarmiento, who's a really good director, a great director who loved the book, you know, and followed with it a couple years ago when it went through different option stuff, and then said, you know, if I bring this here, get this person here, you know, I want to be involved with it. And so that happened. That's one of the things that happens too, is you develop people who are, find people who are very passionate about what happens, you know, happens with it. And so, you know, he's, you know, he's a person that, you know, Marcel, I owe, you know, a debt of gratitude for, you know, the state that's in. And we'll see, you know, hopefully this thing happens, you know. Right now, the producers are at, you know, Toronto International Film Festival, saying, hey, you know, want to fund a movie and, you know, see what we can do. And there's a long road to it. But it came from, that all came from just intensity and saying, you know, I'm going to lock myself in my room and I'm going to write and I'm going to figure out a path to make things better as quickly as I can. And if you people, the problem, we talk about this, I talked about this Justin the other day, Justin Robert Young, I don't know if you guys know him. He'd be great on here some point.
Yeah, you should get him on.
I don't know, he's kind of
maybe,
a wild
maybe
animal.
Sometime if I can't make it, you can bring him on.
Yeah, well, we hope you that won't happen. But
yeah, me too.
So Justin and I were talking about the fact that I came across this quote, and my life has changed radically in the last 3 weeks. I've had a significant, hugely impactful thing, positive, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing that's changed. And it started from about 3 weeks ago. You know, I keep waking up in the middle of the night, very anxious about my future, very anxious about what I'm trying to do and going like, man, do I know what I'm doing or whatever? And you know, you stay up late at night staring at the ceiling, trying to entertain yourself. And then finally you fall asleep and then you get up the next day and you don't kind of care with that much intensity that you did before. This time I woke up, it was a Monday, woke up 7:30 in the morning. And remembered, like, yeah, I was really stressed out last night, and I'm not writing as much as I should be. I'm not writing nearly as much as I should be doing, and I need to get back into that groove, because my problem was I would get up after surfing the web for a while, go get lunch, come back from lunch, hang out leisurely, and then finally start to write in the evening. And I was lucky that I can write really fast, and so if I got behind, I could catch up, but that really wasn't a good pattern. So I made a decision 3 weeks ago when I woke up one Monday morning. It was like, go get caffeine, go get a donut or whatever so you have the energy, sit down at your keyboard and write before you go to lunch. Mm-hmm. I sat down, I wrote before I went to lunch. Came back, wrote again. Kept doing it day after day after day. In 2 weeks' time, I finished a novel I was working on. You know, and I've written novels in shorter times, but this was a consistent, let me try to work at it. And I'd gotten a problem where I had novels were taking, I had one novel take me 3 months, which was horrifying for me. But this thing, I finished it in 3 weeks. And then I went to In-N-Out Burger to say, that was a great job. You know what though? Like, what was my average? I only did 4,000 words a day. That's good. But you know, one day I did 10,000. I said, you know, a long time ago, I wrote 17,000 words in one day. and I normally, my pattern is I would finish a book and then I'd pat myself on the back and not do anything for a while because like, hey, I finished a book. I said, you know what? I had a lot of fun this time. I had a lot of fun writing this time. When I get back for lunch, what if I just try to write something else? And I had an idea that I said, oh, I'll go do that. I'm like, no, let's do this now. So I had an idea for a story that would make a perfect novella. Got back from lunch, sketched out what I needed to do. 24 hours later, I had written 20,000 words.
Holy
cow! Finished this novella.
Okay. That's amazing.
And I love the premise. I won't share with you yet, but I'm going to try to get this done and get this out there soon. I have a friend who's a director. I said, listen, we need to go shop this thing around because it'd be really cool. But it was just this momentum. And then after that, I jumped right into another. I have another. I said, let me do. And I had to go to, you know, something in Atlanta. But I had an idea there and I came back and I jumped right into like, oh, I have another idea for a novella, which will probably be novel length by Monday. And so the thing that changed for me is I said, the moment I get up, I'm about being a writer. I can have a few minutes of surfing the web before I get out of bed. But once I get out of bed, I'm a writer today. And I can go write, go to lunch. And after that, you know, I can do whatever I want. But I'll want to get back into it if I'm that excited. And this sort of was funny because at the same time I tried this habit, I've been reading the book Power of Habit on your recommendation, Brian. I was also listening to an audiobook when I went for a walk at night. And I love these old-timey sort of self-help stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I was going back to The Richest Man in Babylon, which was by
so good.
Yeah, George Samuel Klassen wrote this book, which is actually a collection of pamphlets. And I'm walking along, and this thing, I listen to this thing in my head. I go, oh, that's so good. I have to replay it. And I've told it to my other friends, and they've all gone, oh, yeah. And I'll read this passage to you. And basically, the premise of the book is these people in ancient Babylon. It's not a true story, by the way. But
it's a series of parables, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They go to this man who's supposed to be the richest man in Babylon to ask him how he became so wealthy. And he tells them the habits and the things that he did.
And by the way, keep in mind that the two main characters, one's a chariot maker and he's the best chariot maker in the land. The other is a minstrel. He's the best minstrel in the land. And their old elementary school friend who was not as smart as they were, not as talented as they were, and yet somehow is the richest man in Babylon.
Did not realize that elementary school's in Babylon. That's
Well, yeah, but whatever. When they were children.
So Arkad is the name, and he talks to me. He says, "Willpower," retorted Arkad. "What nonsense. Do you think willpower gives a man the strength to lift a burden the camel cannot carry, or to draw a load the oxen cannot budge? Willpower is but the unflinching purpose to carry a task you set yourself to fulfillment. If I set for myself a task, be it ever so trifling, I shall see it through. How else shall I have confidence in myself to do important things? Should I say to myself, 100 days as I walk across the bridge into the city, I will pick from the road a pebble and cast it into the stream,' I would do it. If on the 7th day I passed by without remembering, I would not say to myself, 'Tomorrow I will cast 2 pebbles, which will do as well.' Instead, I would retrace my steps and cast the pebble." And it goes on to say that I wouldn't then decide on the 20th day it was useless or whatever. But that
And that's the thing is, like, he says, you know, I wouldn't get impatient and reach over and grab a fistful of pebbles and just throw a whole bunch over. It's
most important thing is, like, how many, like, I look at how many times, like, I miss, like, oh, I'll go write. I didn't write it today, but, you know, tomorrow I'll write double. Tomorrow I'll do this.
Or the reverse, where you're like, yesterday I did 20,000 words, so today I could take it easy. I got way ahead of schedule yesterday. I don't know if I've shared this on the program, but this is the quite possibly the single most important book that shaped my entire career. You know, the idea that a part of everything you earn is yours to keep is, as a matter of fact, CJ, I talked him into it. You know, I gave it to CJ, and CJ, it deeply affected him. And CJ, at one of his lectures, ended up buying an entire pallet of this book, and for 2 years just gave it to everyone he met and remotely cared about, hoping that that it would fall on at least some good ears. And in fact, we usually, if we ever give a cash gift to, like, a graduate from high school, we'll usually include a copy of it as well. But The Richest Man in Babylon, because it is written in a timeless age, its lessons are utterly timeless as well.
There's a version on Audible. There's many versions of it because it's fallen into the public domain. That the narrator is Grover Gardner is the narrator of the version I've listened to. And you can buy it on right now for $2 on Amazon.
What?
You can own it outright. $2. $2 for the Audible version of it.
All right. Richest.
$1.95.
Man, so not even $2.
Yeah. And I'll play you his voice here. And
Here we go.
I got chapter 12.
Oh, wrong book.
Here, I got a third day.
I got it.
Babylonian engine. To see whether they knew how to attract good luck. The sun had just set like a great red ball of fire shining through the haze of desert dust when Arkad strolled to his accustomed platform.
Anyhow, that's the guy's voice. He's got that old timey lot of pell-mells, whatever, but.
Yeah, man. Hang on. I got to sign in to Amazon here so I could buy that. I'm not going to use the credit for it because it's so cheap. Riches.
Oh, yeah. Don't waste credit on
$2. $1.95. Just buy it.
Yeah. It's one of those books that I'll reread every 3 or 4 years. And each time you get a new lesson. My favorite is, I don't know if you've gotten there yet, but he eventually tells the story of a man whose, you know, debts were so great that he got sold into slavery. I mean, you know, talk about utterly despondent, had nothing there, and showed how by providing value and that by remembering that a part of everything you earn is yours to keep, he's able to go from slavery to a position of wealth that he could buy off his own debt. And then he goes about paying off all his debtors, even though he doesn't have to, and eventually becomes wealthy himself. And when you hear it expressed in the simplest of terms, in terms of gold pieces for hard labor, that's the brilliance of it, is that it's a blank canvas for you to project your own labors, whether they be creative or working for a large corporation.
No, that's a very valuable lesson. I read it years ago as a paperback, and this is my first time as an audiobook, so I don't remember. I'll have to get to that. And that's that thing you point out there, the idea of paying back debtors when you don't have to is a very – and part of the reason you do that is the idea that you might say, well, you know, I don't have to because of bankruptcy or this because whatever. Well, the next time you want to start something, if you paid people back, they're the first ones you go to and they'll help you. If you don't pay them back, you have to find an entirely new group of people
to pursue.
And also there's something in you, like that's baggage you're going to carry, knowing that you owe that money. And you may be the kind of, sociopath that could just write that off. But meanwhile,
well, in some cases, there are people like there's just extenuating circumstances where they're never going to be able to.
Sure. And that's fine. And there are genuinely places where it's like, yeah, I don't have the money. I'm never going to have the money. You plan to make money because you thought I was a good bet. Turns out I'm a bad bet. And this is the end of it. You could buy back your debt for pennies on the dollar or whatever. But I don't know if I talked about it on the air, but Marco Tempest has an amazing story of how he was flying high in the early 90s with the production, but had a scammy manager who left him holding an insurmountable amount of debt and just bailed on him. And he had to start over from scratch. And he spent several years doing all these corporate gigs and just because he couldn't handle the idea that people knew him as a deadbeat or had his company associated with being a deadbeat. And he went back and paid back hundreds of thousands of dollars to all of these debtors because he just didn't know. He was off busy doing the magic show and didn't know he was getting screwed on the management side.
That takes a lot of character to say, let me go in there and, get rid of this or take care of this. But that's the understanding of, like, I don't want to live with that.
And one great thing, and again, I think I'm going to be on, this is my pick for sure for this conversation. Whether you are young, fresh out of college, trying to figure out how to shape your future, whether you are deeply in debt, trying to figure out how to get back on top, whether you're late in life and wondering if it's too late to get yourself to a place of financial security, there are parables and lessons in each of these. And because they are written in that timeless manner, there are true truths, as a certain animal fairy would say, that you'll be able to take away from this.
I'm going to say, like, let's have that as our pick, our joint pick, if we're all cool with that.
Yeah.
And I'll leave with a story here, and I think you guys are probably may have covered this. An amazing success story is, of course, Notch, Marcus Notch Person, who took somebody else's base idea, with permission, and made a billion-dollar franchise out of Minecraft. And this guy sold it. Billionaire, became a billionaire, was able to buy one of the most expensive homes in all of LA out from under all the pop stars and everybody else who was trying to get it out, because guess what? His video game money was a lot greener than their money, and he had a little bit of an event took place on Twitter where he was talking about he put a thing on Twitter that said the problem with getting everything is you run out of reasons to keep trying, and human interaction becomes impossible due to imbalance. And he was basically a little bit melancholy over the fact that he's stupidly wealthy right now, and it's made problems difficult, relationships. It's just that it's everybody around him is different. The girls who may be attracted to him are different, and he feels very, very isolated and alone.
That's true, because not so much that I would know from the money perspective, but I certainly, I don't know. And you're probably in the same place, Andrew. I would say, would it be fair to say that you and me are in a different place from a celebrity perspective than we were 5 years ago?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's this. We have a basic cable credibility kind of thing there that comes through there, and there's people bet money on us and said, we'll do this. We'll put people have gone, had multiple people go in and say, okay, we'll put you out there and go do this, which carries undue weight, carries an inappropriate amount of weight in an environment where, if you have a sex tape and a very rich father, you can have a TV show.
Well, and that's what I'm getting
Tom,
at.
Tom,
0 for 2.
Well, Here's it's a double-edged sword, and I understand that sense of isolation, because on the one hand, it is pretty cool, those moments that people say, oh, I know you from that thing, skip the line, come on in, or have this before someone else, or whatever those little things are. It's delightful. It's great that we could get on camera and say, I think it'd be cool if I made a card game about presidential debates. And then you know, because you're known, you can make that stuff happen. However, it is crushingly isolating when you realize that you can't be out in public and pick your nose and not have the suspicion that somebody's, you know, recording it, you know, and it's like you find yourself on best behavior at all times. And again, that's the trade-off. But I could understand how, like, let me put it this way. I am glad I am not dating, because if I was dating, everyone I talked to, I would constantly be thinking, like, why is she here? Is she here for this? She here for that? She's the kind of person who's going to talk about what we do and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. The advantage of living in a place in LA is, you know, yeah, far more famous and wealthier people out there. So if a girl's dating me, I kind of know why, you know.
Whatever notoriety I have, I enjoy very much the fact that when someone comes up and recognizes me, it's because they like something I did, and that's it. And
I've been there. I've been there for both of you guys, you know, in very random, not just geeky, nerdy places where your fans go up to your nerdy male fans go up to you to tell you how much they love what you do. And it's very sincere, though. It's they're not going up to you because you're some guy they saw on TV. They're going up to you because they listen and they connect with your art or what you do.
Right.
Yeah, like the guy I saw in the grocery store who was like, hey, I love Corn Killers, you know? And he went off to finish his grocery shopping and I went off to finish mine. There was nothing weird about it.
That's perfect.
To me, that's perfect.
Yeah, I realized, like, for me, like, I was at a party and it was family and all their friends had seen the show. And it was a weird, unpleasant experience.
It was your family?
Yeah, and friends of my family.
Yeah, no, I just did a family reunion, and it's a weird, eclectic mix because you have some set of the family that saw you poop your pants, and then there's other subsets of the family.
Well, it was their friends that made it weird. I mean, they're nice people, but it's just like, oh, do this. And like, it's like, man, I just kind of want to sit here and eat cake.
Yeah.
And I was very uncomfortable because it was, then it's like, oh, they want to talk about, you know, the conversation stem around things that you've had that same conversation 500 times, yeah, you know,
you find yourself dipping into familiar material and it feels artificial and weird.
Yeah. And I know that, like, I've always looked at it like a means to an end. Like, I'm not a person that ever wanted to, like, I mean, maybe when I was younger and I didn't know any better, that wanted, you know, people just to go up to me on the street and be like, hey, you're so-and-so or whatever. I just like to do cool things. That's what I want to be able to do, is do cool things. And so, you know, and that's having a little bit of, you know, doing a little tiny little show and being able to have that experience. Like, great. This just gels for me what I know, what I want and what I don't want. It's about the work. And that's what we were talking about before. I know what the work I want to do. Yeah. If I'm on camera, it's because I'm going to be promoting. I want to do it because I'm promoting science or something, not because I just want to put my stupid face on TV.
Well, and that's the thing, is like, there is a certain, it's that, you know, product becoming platform thing. It's like, you know, the product was you did the TV show and now that becomes a platform, you know, to help bolster your ability to sell books, and
your face becomes a platform for science.
Yes, you balance science on your face.
It opened, like, I have a project which I'll maybe be able to talk a little bit more in a couple months. That's, you know, a great fun science thing that I've wanted to do with a high profile and everything. And that happened because I did the other thing. Yep. The other thing happened because of that. You know.
Yeah, man.
The key is to go do things, no matter what level of success you have. And that's when we're talking about specialization versus not specialization. Like, just do stuff that you like to do, because doing things will more often lead to other things than not doing things.
Brian set foot out in front of his doorstep. You know, Tom pursued journalism, and then Tom turned on those microphones and kept doing that, you know, every day, doing shows. Even if nobody wanted to see you, nobody wanted to hear you, nobody cared.
That's how
Tom,
you know,
still did it.
Well, it started with me doing subbrilliant.com, which started from me doing an e-zine because I wanted to do it. Like, those are both basically unknown things from the 90s that I did because I just wanted to do them, and they led to other things.
Yeah. An e-zine.
Yeah, right?
Gentlemen,
it was a
thank you very much.
Yeah, man. It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.